So life and literature, the essence of an epic historical event does not have to sacrifice what is true. It does not have to do that. A myth can be true. It simply needs to carefully distill the essence of the event so that it reflects the powerful shared experience of our lives. Many of these things, many more of these things Jesus did, but if I took the time to write more about them, they would fill the pages of the earth. Okay, so you're telling me John made decisions? He left things out? There's stories out there of Jesus doing things and saying things that we're not aware of? Yes. Here's the myth of the Gospel of John. According to Leland Riker, if we can see our own experience in the characters and events of history, it has captured something universal about life. Mm. History tells us what happened, while literature tells us what happens. And so, again...
idea here is kind of seeing ourselves in the deal, right? Yeah. And so that we can identify with it, right?
Right. Yeah. Thus, a good history is crafted with the art of good literature. It is why the historical narratives of the Bible are deeply personal and told with literary genius.
Yeah, yeah, good. And so storytelling, he tells us, has the capacity to unearth truth in sundry regions where the most articulate propositions might flounder, right? So a story, we can put together truth in a certain way, he's suggesting here, that if we just say the truth and tell it, may not work, right? People may not get it. They may not identify with it. But with a story, he says, it's a different thing. He says the art of literature appeals to our understanding through our imagination. Mm-hmm. And if we recognize and feel the, for instance, horror of Cain's behavior, let's say, in the story of Cain and Abel, then we've grasped the truth of that particular story.
Right.
Right.
So how many people have read Plato and Socrates and Aristotle? Now, how many people have seen and written on The Matrix? And how much has The Matrix for, so much so that they made a fourth movie for who knows what reasons other than the money. For 25 years, that movie has been lightning in the bottle, a staple that you couldn't reproduce. That, you know, I think most people even admit the first one is phenomenal. The next two are fine, depending on where you fall, or they're terrible. Yeah. I think they're fine. But the Matrix hits on so many things that you could pull out anything from that, from any perspective. Because why? Because we're hit. They hit on that storytelling aspect. Yeah. That
it's a well
the human condition.
Told story.
That's good. Yeah. It was just nice to watch The Matrix again to think about The Matrix. So storytelling invigorates our virtues as it equally exposes our vices. It concretizes the abstract and injects knowledge deeper into our mental awareness.
Right. So it makes it concrete, right? It makes it stable, right? It establishes it as the idea here, right?
Yeah. The narrative thread woven through the Bible in itself is the paradigm of visceral storytelling as truth. Its power lies in the uncanny ability to diagnose the inner character of the human life and history via a divinely infallible microscope, Hebrews 4:12 says.
Yeah. So that's what the scripture does for us, right? So now what he's going to do here is to talk about this whole idea of what he calls the monomyth, right? The emerging monomyth, right?
That's the big black block in 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? Yeah.
So he says, ever since Aristotle, perhaps the world's first literary critic, right? Okay, Aristotle. careful analysis of storytelling has revealed certain universal, he says, commonalities. Mm-hmm. Every well-crafted story devises a poignant conflict that piques the audience's interest, which then demands resolution in the unfolding of the plot, right? Mm-hmm. So he says the form that such storytelling takes is called the monomyth or the one story, right? It's a compelling narrative, and it needs a compelling crisis, right? A ruinous set of circumstances that cry out for resolution. So that's the monolithic type or monomythic, rather, type of issue with regard to stories, right?
Yeah, and you see in the 60s and 70s, you had these movies come out that were kind of countercultural, and they tried to deconstruct this type of storytelling. Francis Schaeffer talks about this too, where these people come along and, you know, they're doing interpretive dance and they're talking about the color purple for 60 minutes, or you're only looking at a blue screen or something along those lines. But even there, you know it as different because you're informed by this monomyth type storytelling. They're deconstructing it, which means they're using it to say, look how different I am. Right. Look how different this is. Right. This doesn't have characters in a play, in the confines of a setting with conflict and resolution. Right. But by you pointing that out or by you doing that, you are actually referring to it. And so,
and you're telling your own story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's that aspect of the artist can't devolve himself out of the art, no matter how much postmodernism tries to do that. So the ideal plot is a U shaped. So the letter U, not the us royal U.
So it goes like this is what he's suggesting, right?
Good.
Or does it go like this?
Yeah, upside down U?
Yeah.
More like that.
Yeah, I think that's what he's saying.
It's the bell curve.
Yeah.
Good is followed by the descending darkness of catastrophe, and then followed by the ascending restoration of good again in some way. The stories that leave the most lasting impression are the ones in which the darkest hour is just before the dawn.
Right. So maybe it is this kind of you. We start off with good, and then we descend into darkness, and then we finally end up.
So it depends.
And they lived happily ever after.
Yeah, on your characters, yeah. The dress is torn, glass slippers, yeah. Some of the best stories do not end well, but in either case, they highlight our insatiable need for good endings. You know, how many times have you read a story and then the happily ever after happens, or and then everyone died, the world exploded, and you're like, well, that's just unsatisfying. I just wasted however the short story
And he's going to deal with these tragedies, right?
Yeah,
is what they're called.
Yeah, right? Not everything needs to be and they lived happily ever after.
Right.
The story formula is key there.
Yeah, exactly. And so he says, obviously we don't like plots with flat lines, right?
There's a guy and nothing happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
They need to be
brilliant.
Right. There need to be some indomitable conflicts, he tells us, and there need to be some what he calls catastrophic types of situations. So you catastrophic is kind of the word for a good catastrophe, right? That's the U prefix there has to do with good, right? Like eulogy is a good word, right? So U catastrophic is a good catastrophe. That's what he says is needed in a good story. He says all those specific storylines differ, whether composed as comedies, tragedies, romance, satire, epics, or whatever. The overall arc of the plot undergirds a native impulse, he tells us, to contrast good and evil, success and failure, prosperity and adversity, in such a way that what is perceived to be good and right and true should triumph. Right? If not the resolution of the story itself, then at least in the minds of the audience. Right?
Yeah. Braveheart. Braveheart loses in the end. It's a terrible story. Everyone remembers Braveheart.
Oh, yeah.
This unifying universal storyline is found not only in the long history of literature, but more recently in our present filmmaking and television era. Mm-hmm. The most basic forms that this monomyth takes are tragedies and comedies. There's the two faces of the frowny face and the silly face. According to the great medieval poet Dante, a tragedy is a story that begins with joy and ends in pain. Right. Comedy begins in pain and ends with joy. Our souls long for good outcome of a comedy, and we dread the painful outcome of a tragedy.
Yeah. So those are the two basic kinds. Right?
Hamlet, everyone dies, but it's fulfilling.
Yeah, it's a tragedy,
here's what revenge gets you, utter death and destruction.
Exactly, right? So he says even in tragedies, we're encouraged to long even more for the ending of a comedy, right? It's important to note that tragedy is not a celebration of evil's triumphs. Right. Few stories, he says, consciously seek to celebrate what is perceived as evil, even if they do so unwittingly or with a consciously distorted ethics. Right. Instead, he tells us that tragedy produces grieving over the good that ought to have triumphed. Yet it fell short because of the story's flawed tragic heroes who are overcome by their flaws or the crisis they face, right? So that's what a good tragedy does. It allows for our longing for the good, right? Mm-hmm. He says the history of the monomyth tells us that we need both the tragedy and the comedy. Life does not always end well, but this creates greater longing for how life ought to end, mm-hmm. right? So that's what a good tragedy does for us.